The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is our monthly episode 4, where we get to ask our speaker all the questions that we've gotten from our episodes for the month so far. And by the way, thanks for all your questions and feedback. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. It's Q&A week, which is always thrilling to be able to deal with questions that were probably too bold for us to ask in the first 3 weeks. And so here comes trouble. We're so fortunate to have Dr. Jeremy Kendrick back with us. Jeremy, welcome.
Thank you. So happy to be back. Appreciate the opportunity.
Glad that you're willing to make the leap again. Have you developed any conflicts that you want to talk about?
Despite my best efforts, I am still penniless from conflicts of interest. So nope, nothing to disclose for you today.
Okay. And nothing that you want to, no conflicts you want to reveal in a psychoanalytic way or anything?
Now that would probably require you charging me. And again, at this point, I'm penniless. So we're going to have to skip.
If somebody wanted the chance to talk to you or one of your very learned colleagues about psychiatric issues beyond today's Q&A, are you guys still doing that call-up thing?
We sure are. Appreciate the opportunity to plug it. We're still going strong Monday to Fridays from 12 to 4:30 p.m. There is a child analyst psychiatrist at the ready for any questions, be them diagnostic clarification, medication questions, resources, you know, Whatever you might have, we stand at the ready. And our phone number remains 801-587-3636. We just are waiting for your call. So we'd love to have an opportunity to chat with anybody in the state who wants to talk with us.
801-587-3636.
You've got it.
And as a user of the line, I just tell you, it's a wonderful resource. So thank you guys for doing that.
It's our pleasure. It's been a lot of fun getting to meet some of the great providers out there in the state.
And thanks to the state of Utah, too, for providing at least some of the funding. Is that correct?
Exactly. You know, I think our state has really stepped up in its dedication to providing resources for the mental health of the citizens of the state. So, yeah, big thanks to
it's huge. We're very appreciative. Well, are you ready for some questions?
You bet.
I think you've seen these already because, you know, we don't want to broadside you with anything, but here are a couple of questions that we wanted to ask clarifications and expansions of what you've already talked about. Question number one, does dosage of SSRIs depend more on age or body mass? If you have an adult-sized child, should I be more inclined to push the dose, or is it more an age-related metabolism thing?
You know, this is a great question. And I would add one other factor there that really has to be considered, and that's genetic. Based on any individual's genotype for their cytochrome system, you know, we see different SSRIs metabolized at different rates for different individuals. And so a lot of times it really doesn't matter how big or how small, you know, body fat, you name it. Like, there are, in general, as individuals age, that individual will require a higher dose as they age and get older and bigger. But I think the biggest thing to consider is just any one individual may metabolize the medicine very differently. There are genotype testing that you can do to actually see how your genotype lays out as far as its metabolism of different drugs. But, you know, that's not even necessary. I think the old adage of start low, go slow is always the best route. And I think you'll be surprised to see that, you know, some really large teenagers may do very well at an SSRI dose that you had not anticipated being effective. So that's why, you know, you want to start the medicine cautiously, looking for the least effective dose, and then titrating from there as that individual ages.
You mentioned when we talked previously that that sometimes family history of response to a particular medication may be of help in choosing a medication. Is the same thing true for metabolism? Is that predictive at all?
Yes, it absolutely can be, because you also see adverse events oftentimes coming across first-degree family members. So if a member has responded well to a medicine, that's really good. That's really good information for us to have. If they've had a particularly bad side effect to a medicine, we also take that into account, because oftentimes first-degree family members will have similar side effects, which really can be related to how they're metabolizing the drug.
Good point. Very helpful. Question number two, if you're changing medications, is there a great risk in a so-called hot swap? That is, rather than tapering one medication over time and then going back up on the other, just using a modest dose of the new agent and changing directly. It seems challenging sometimes to have someone taper off and then back on to a new medication.
Yeah, this I think speaks to the idea of what I would probably more in practice describe as a cross taper. I don't know that I ever start a medicine and then just stop the other one in its place. I think it is absolutely unnecessary to taper somebody completely off of one antidepressant while waiting to start the new one. The older MAO inhibitors notwithstanding, because there's some cross-reactivity there where you do have to do a med washout. But if you're cross-titrating from one SSRI to another SSRI, or from an SSRI to an SNRI, my general practice, and I would say absolutely safe to do, is start at about 50% of the dose of the new agent, simultaneously cutting down to 50% of the old agent, and leave them there for a few days, and then work up to your anticipated dose of the new agent and discontinuing the old. The bigger question here is the half-life of the individual agents. So medications like venlafaxine or Effexor have a very, very short half-life, and it doesn't matter if you start a new medicine in its place. People have discontinuation effects very, very quickly because of its short half-life. So those cross tapers generally work better on medicines with longer half-lives. So just be aware of that. If you have a medicine with a particularly short half-life, you are probably going to have to taper that medicine over the course of a week or two.
Very helpful. Thank you. Third question. When you were talking about cognitive behavioral therapy, you mentioned the Coping Cat program. Is that a program that could be used by patients and families independent of their relationship with the therapist? For instance, if someone was having trouble getting an appointment or something, would that or something similar be a potential stopgap while finding resources for a patient?
Yeah, this is a really great point to make. The Coping Cat program in particular was really developed. There's actually a therapist manual, a parent manual, and a workbook manual for the patient. It was really developed to be done in that therapist-patient kind of interaction. So it's not a really good, what I would call, quote unquote, self-help CBT book. That said, if you go onto Amazon and search CBT self-help for kids, you'll come up with some really great options. And CBT in and of itself is the core foundation. And a lot of people have adapted these behavioral principles into workbooks that parents and kids can work on together. Prior to the podcast, I just did a quick search. I found a couple really good ones. One was called Think Good, Feel Good. Had great reviews. I looked at some of the content really based on cognitive behavioral principles. And that is really meant for a parent and a child to kind of do at home and sit down and go through and talk over. And it's really built for, you know, kids and parents working together and would work independent of a therapist. I think when you can have a therapist in the mix, it's very helpful from the sense of coaching, psychoeducation, helping kids develop good coping skills. But there's a lot of these skills that really a good, well-informed parent can absolutely, you know, I always say that the kids, you know, most readily accessible therapist is their parents. That's just the role parents have. Unfortunately, there are all sorts of filters that happen in that therapeutic relationship that having an independent third party therapist can be very helpful with. So there's a lot parents can do, and there are books out there available for them that accomplish, I think, the spirit of what this question is asking. Because yeah, we know that it's hard to get into these therapists and finding a good therapist. So I think it's a great question, and there are some good options out there.
Terrific. Thank you. Here's kind of a ball of wax. You alluded to issues with shyness. Does the world of psychiatry have systematic feelings about introversion versus shyness versus anxiety, which sounds to me like the most reticent cage match in the world? I know that for my patients, Susan Cain's book, Quiet, has been a great jumping off point to talk about introversion to parents who worry about their own or their kids' introversion. Is there anything you want to talk about with those issues?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. And it speaks to something that we, I think, briefly touched on in the first podcast. Mm-hmm. And that is that the core of anxiety disorders is fear. It is fear as an entity. And when you look at individuals who may be shy, and again, shyness is not a clinical diagnosis. People right. who are shy can have different motivations for their shyness. Right. But introversion as a concept, and when I was reading some of the writings that were alluded to here by Susan Cain, I think the idea is there are some individuals by their nature who just have a preference to kind of spend time by themselves and are not driven or motivated to be around other people. But the motivation for that is really preference. It's not fear. Individuals who fear social situations, and usually that fear is the fear of being judged or the fear of making a mistake, that they feel so intensely uncomfortable in those situations that they avoid those situations. And again, when they look at the reason they're doing that, it's not because they wouldn't prefer to be around other people. It's that they are absolutely unable to do so because mm-hmm. they are so anxious. And it's interesting. I had read this question. I was actually talking to one of my patients with social anxiety. And I said, you know, I'm curious. I just went into this interaction blind. I said, what is the reason why you do not enjoy being around other people? What is it that drives that? It was so funny because they really spelled it out exactly as this concept was talking about. They said, you know, it is exhausting to be in these situations and constantly worry about what I said and what people are interpreting as a result of what I said. And I feel like I have to apologize for the things I said and check in with people and make sure that they're okay with the thing I said. They said, after a while, it's just miserable and I'd rather just be home alone. And I think that conceptualizes what social anxiety at its core is it's a fear-driven insecurity. That absolutely, by the way, you can have improvement with, that you can push back against with cognitive behavioral principles, with medications, that can be lifted. Whereas the idea of being introverted is, you know, some people just kind of prefer to hang out by themselves. And so I think those are the two real important things in understanding our patients. Just because somebody social isolates does not necessarily mean they have social anxiety. It may be a preference thing, but if it's not a preference thing and they really want to be around other people, but don't feel they're able to because of this fear, that's when it becomes really problematic, because that's when you start getting things like loneliness, depression, all these other things coming on, because most people by them better than nature are social creatures and do want to be around other people.
Is there treatment for people who seem to lack the ability to self-edit?
Well, this is a really good question. I was having this this conversation with this person because, you know, socially, it almost becomes for these individuals a bit of a self-fulfilling promise, because, you know, when you're around somebody who constantly needs to check in about what they're saying, it can start to be somewhat tiresome, you know, and so even though these individuals probably are not awkward at their baseline, their anxiety makes them somewhat awkward over time. And so I think that's why recognizing that as a target of treatment becomes really, really helpful. As far as folks that just can't self-edit, that's a whole different diagnostic category to talk about.
I think every Thanksgiving dinner has to have at least one of those.
Yeah, exactly. you got to add a little flavor, a little dialogue every once in a while.
Fair enough. Here's the last question. Is there a best way to approach the issue of anxiety in kids who have abdominal pain, chest pain, headaches, et cetera? Is it just a matter of style to introduce that to the conversation? Is there any magic that you recommend, you know, in those situations where it's becoming clearer and clearer that there may be a strong underlay of anxiety that's driving these somatic symptoms, but how do you broach the topic?
Yeah, this is such a great question. And you know, in my training, you know, training in pediatrics and in psychiatry, doing the triple board thing, you know, that bridge of the psychiatric and medical, you know, somatic world was always a big area of interest for me. And I will say that this becomes tough. And sometimes, you know, in the pediatrics primary care world, we dig ourselves a bit of a pit because we really are focused on we want to see, are there biological things that we need to figure out here? You know,
right.
We really focus on that pretty heavily. And when it becomes clear that there's not a readily identifiable, what we would call kind of, you know, biological entity from the sense of a classic medical diagnosis, all of a sudden patients are left feeling like, so this is the classic, like, so you're saying it's in my brain, you're saying it's made up. Yeah. And I think this is where it becomes really, really important to do some very, very clear education with patients. And one of my favorite conversations to have with patients is talking about the very, very real link between anxiety and emotions and the physical manifestation of those, and that there are physiologic correlates with this. You know, I often tell patients the largest concentration of serotonin receptors outside the brain is in the gut. You know, these neurochemicals interface with each other, and the pain, discomfort, et cetera, that they feel is just as real as if it were being manifest because of a inflammatory bowel disease or something like that. And that helping them understand that this is just as real of a diagnostic category as any of these other medical things, but that the pain that they're experiencing is a symptom of an underlying diagnosis. And just like if, you know, the underlying diagnosis were some inflammatory bowel disease and we were going to start them on some type of medication to treat that, you know, the underlying etiology, the underlying cause of this is this neurochemical imbalance in the brain that we need to treat. And I will often, you know, tell them, it's really, really important to remember that, you know, we can't just treat the symptom. You know, it's like if you just treated a fever without really paying attention to the underlying cause of the fever. And so that's why this anxiety piece that we have identified that you have that really is contributing to this, we really have to treat that. And so while it seems like we're focusing on things like behavioral structure and getting you back to school and getting you on a medication and getting you into therapy, how does that really relate to the pain and discomfort I'm feeling in my gut? I really try to tie those two together and help them understand that this is no different than any other medical explanation that we would have for the discomfort. And at that point, you get away from this idea that it's just them making it up or coming up with it.
Yeah.
I mean, at its core, the pain becomes an avoidance mechanism, just like any other, you know, in obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, these other things that take the focus away from actually pushing back against the anxiety. And so it's really helpful that once kids start to focus on that piece, you actually see that being quite a bit of a relief for them. And I've actually seen people with functional abdominal pain, other types of, you know, somatic manifestations of psychiatric illness, that just that understanding, that taking the pressure off, actually leads to some immediate symptomatic relief. And so I think the psychoeducation piece is the most important, helping them understand that this is just as biological as any other condition, but then really focusing on the underlying cause and not letting the attention be focused on the pain. Because then you're talking about, well, like, to avoid the pain, then we have to keep you home from school and we have to do all these things, which really just compounds the problem. And I would say that this is why, like, treating these conditions in the primary care setting is so much more effective than me seeing these patients for the very first time in a referral, because I don't have the rapport that primary care docs have developed over a lifetime with these patients. And so that rapport is the most valuable currency in having these discussions and helping, because they trust these individuals. So I think that's a really, really important piece to remember here, is using that rapport to give education about the biology and then really doing the right thing for the underlying cause, which is sometimes counterintuitive to the patient. Like, you're telling me I have to go back to school when I'm having this horrible stomach ache, you know, and that's where the, you know, selling the intervention becomes really important.
Well, again, the family dynamic here is that anxious kids often have anxious parents as well. And that compounds the difficulty of the discussion.
It sure does. And that psychoeducation and selling that you do is more geared towards the parents than anything, because the parents are the ones that are going to have to hold the line with the behavioral interventions. They're the ones that are going to have to coach the kids with their coping skills and not just focus on avoidance of the discomfort. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Well, this has been very helpful. Thank you so much for spending some time with us this month. This has been very, very useful. Now, if a situation arose that I was having trouble deciding what to do with one of my psychiatric patients on a Monday through Friday, is there any chance I could talk to someone like you?
Absolutely. You know, if not myself, one of my incredibly skilled and equally attractive colleagues are standing by at the call-up line here at the Huntsman Mental Health Institute now at the University of Utah. So we've officially launched into our new era there. 12 o'clock to 4:30 p.m., just give us a call. It's a quick check-in with our contact center. We have to get some brief demographic. The state wants data to back this program.
Sure.
We do have to take a few minutes of your time to get some demographic data, but then you're connected directly with one of our psychiatrists and we can launch right into a discussion.
Yep.
And just to remind you that phone number one last time, it's 801-587-3636. And we really look forward to speaking with folks.
Operators are standing by.
Call now.
For the first five callers, any bonuses?
Yeah, you get an extra 5 minutes of consultation time if you call now.
No Ginzu knives?
Unfortunately not.
Well, I'm glad to hear that because that means the state's being responsible with our money. Jeremy, thank you so much for your time. Thanks you even more for your expertise. You've been very, very helpful. I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
All right. Stay tuned because next week will be another week and we'll have more enthralling things to talk about. We'll talk to you then.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.